So what sort of response do you get from individuals when after a gig do they come and talk to you very seriously about music or about, you know, how do they...
It depends. Yeah, I get a bit of that at my shows when I'm off with the tour, because off with the band, because we do get a lot of music fans. That was something which we did notice certainly in the first tour, is that our natural constituency seems to be at least as much music fans as it is comedy fans. And, you know, music fans have got a bit of a sense of humour and don't necessarily take their music too seriously, and rightly so, because a bit of a musical education is definitely an asset when you're trying to get into the show I'm doing with the band, you know. I mean, it's not necessary, but if you get that my metal parody is specifically Iron Maiden, if you get that I'm actually specifically doing Iron Maiden, then it'll be that much funnier. It doesn't matter if you don't spot that, it's still quite a funny heavy metal song, but, you know, if you spot that, yep, he's doing Maiden, that somehow makes the whole song make a lot more sense, just as an example. So yeah, at the end of my shows I'll often get a bit of that. At the end of stand-up shows I don't often stick around long enough, because I'm usually on at the end and I just want to go home, you know. So it's only sort of if I'm staying over, I'm doing like the whole weekend at the Glee or something, I might stick around and have a bit of a chat with people. But, you know, as long as it's not the people who go, here you go mate, you can have this, it's two packages, right? yeah, I can really have that. Yeah, that will fit seamlessly into my routine. Who were you watching? Which way round were you facing when I was up, you freak?
Manning and I.
Yeah, exactly. fair enough. As long as they laugh, I don't care.
What's your idea of a really good gig? When do you feel like that? I really cracked it, that was a really excellent gig?
When they get all the little clever bits that I've stuck in there just to keep myself interested. I love that. Because my stand-up set is just full of little sort of references to all manner of shit that I've just put in there to keep myself awake, you know what I mean? And they're not really for the audience's benefit. If they spot them, then woohoo, they're like little Easter eggs in the DVD of my act, you know what I mean? But it's always particularly gratifying when you get a particularly smart and attentive audience and they get all that. You see, you guys are great, you know, you really get what I do.
And does it keep you pushing that further throughout the gig?
Well, it's just, it means your energy stays up.
Yeah.
I mean, some gigs, you're just screaming into a void, you know what I mean? And it saps your bloody energy. Whereas some gigs, all the energy you throw out, you get thrown right back at you. I mean, I'm sounding like a dreadful thespian at this point, but that is very much the case. Some gigs just drain you until you're just this sort of, you know, flaccid, translucent shadow of your former self. Whereas some gigs actually buoy you up, and that's how, you know, suddenly you're written, this is how Springsteen plays for 3 hours, you know what I mean? And then it's only, you know, when you're on your way home, you're just thinking, Jesus, I can't move.
What do you do psychologically when you're caught, say, 5 minutes into a really, into a void gig,
mm-hmm.
and you know you've got another 15 minutes to do? What do you do in your head?
Thinking of money. Or just wonder, I had one of those last night. I was in Worthing, and bless them, they were thick as mints. Worthing's a fascinating little town. It always reminds me of what Brighton would be like if you took everything out of it. It's like Brighton with nothing in it. And this gig, bless them, they were all right. They weren't bad people, but they were a bit... carry on! But you know, it wasn't working. But, I mean, it was working for enough of them. Certainly, once you've lost the whole bloody room, just make your polite exit and get out, because you're not really doing anybody any favours. Trouble is, it's very rare that I will lose the whole room. Basically, what you have is a bunch of gobby chaps have been, like, gobbing off at everybody all night, and people just striking up a conversation with them, not getting any material. Now, I can't be doing with that. I won't let hecklers get the show, make the show about them. I won't do that. I will answer you twice, right? I'll slap you down once, I'll slap you down harder again. After that, I will ignore you. I'm not getting into a conversation with you, because it's not about you. It's about me, you know what I mean? If that sounds egotistical, I'm sorry. I'm the one on stage, and the lights are pointing at me for a reason, you know what I mean? The people came here to listen to somebody, and it wasn't you. Yeah, so I will not make the show about you. And the thing is, I think that kind of pissed them off, because everybody else had me coached. So they didn't start trying to heckle me off, they just got started sulking and talking to each other a bit too loud, you know what I mean? Talking to each other a bit too loud, but I thought, screw it, I'm not going to try and re-engage them because they're not in the show. But I'm looking around the room and I'm making eye contact, and enough of these people are in the show, so I'm going to soldier on, and I'm going to just, because I'm loud enough, I can talk over these bastards, it doesn't matter, I will just keep going and I'll do the show for these guys, you know. I also have a slight advantage in that's an example when you do it a corporate where the room is the wrong layout and they had no idea you were coming and everything. But you're going to have to do your 20 minutes, so you might not get the money. I at least can literally string my funny songs together for 20 minutes and play to the furniture. And I have done that.
You know. It doesn't bother you that much.
Not
at all. Are you going professional mode?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I've got enough, this happens so rarely that it's not like sometimes you will get a weird month where it happens three or four times in a month. And that's when suddenly you start thinking, Jesus, I'm losing it. And sometimes that is actually a good excuse for you to start looking at your material. So that's a mistake that maybe I used to make. It was a mistake. It was certainly when I used to play The Fringe year in, year out, and I was just doing stand-up at The Fringe. And the last time I did The Fringe was 03, and I was with the band, and I don't know if I'm ever going to do The Fringe again, because I don't really enjoy it, and I don't think I'm going to get anything more out of it. But when I did it year in, year out, what you would do, of course, is you would bone up your whole new hour of stuff. So you go up to The Fringe with an hour that's completely different to the hour that lasted. And then in September you come back to the clubs, and what you would be doing, you'd be doing the boiled down 20 minutes set from that hour. And certainly the last couple of times, I used to find the autumn quite rough, and it dawned on me after I'd done this a couple of times that there is a definite difference between the kind of material you do at Edinburgh and the kind of material you do at the clubs. And just because you've got a whole new act together at Edinburgh doesn't necessarily mean that the best 20 minutes of that is actually going to work as a club set. So, you know, I remember there was one time I'd actually had a slightly rough month after I got back from Edinburgh, and it's because I actually hadn't worked out yet that was the problem. And then eventually it did dawn on me, and I rather sheepishly reverted to the stuff I'd been doing in May, and I was rocking again, because that was club material. It wasn't fringe material. Even if you're doing stand-up in the fringe, stand-up in the club, it's very different things. It goes back to what we were saying before. You know, in the fringe, even if there's only 12 people in, they are in to see you, and they are automatically giving you the benefit of the doubt as such, whereas if you're just in a club on a Friday night, they have no idea who you are, and they may very well not give a shit, and it's up to you to make them give a shit. And that, the kind of material that you're doing in Edinburgh may not work that way, so... But these are the things that you discover after you've been doing it for years.
Do you think you'll carry on doing stand-up in the clubs, or would you ideally like to leave that behind, or do you still enjoy doing
I still enjoy it most of the time. It would be nice to be less dependent on it, because it's still a fairly sizable proportion of my income. You know, I mean, I'm doing... You know, at the end of the day, this is my job, and it is how I earn my living, and I make no excuses for the fact that a lot of what I do, I'm earning just to basically for food and stuff, because it's my only source of money. And it is weird when somehow, if you're in the arts, you know, small A, definitely, if you're in performance or whatever, woe betide you if you get caught doing something purely for the cash. Whereas, what does everybody else do their jobs for? This is my job. You know, I don't walk up to somebody who works in an insurance company and say, you completely sold out. You're just working for the Prudential for the money. And it's like, well, what else would I be doing it for? Well, the thing is, you know, yeah, I have a degree of artistic expression available to me within my job, but it's still my damn job, and I have nothing else. So a lot of what I do, it is for the damn money, and I make no apology for that whatsoever. But it would be nice to be less dependent on it. It would be, at the moment, I'm not earning enough with everything else I'm doing that I can just completely walk away from it. But I don't think I would ever completely walk away from it. But, you know, you would do what the big guys do, which is just literally play the clubs you like every now and again. Just for the sheer heck of it, you just turn up and just do, like, you know, one weekend at one of the Glees, or one weekend at the Banana, or one weekend at just, you know, one of the really dinky clubs that just pay, you know, beer money, but are just really good fun to play, you know. And it would be nice to be in that kind of situation. Also, you know, my life is changing. I've got a little girl now, a baby is 3 months old, and, you know, the demands of my time and my priorities are shifting all the time. And, you know, it would be nice to be in the situation where basically you could, apart from a few gigs dotted this and yon, you could basically boil all your live work down to like 4 or 5 weeks in the autumn. Just go out and play 4 or 5 weeks of theatres, and that will be your live stuff, and then you go back to writing books and then TV shows, whatever. I'm not at that stage yet, and there's by no means any guarantee that I'm going to get to that stage. You know, I have to accept that this could be it. This could be as far as it goes. I hope it isn't. And certainly things are moving and developing all the time. I just had a very, very productive meeting with yet another old university friend of mine just this very afternoon, in which we were talking about the idea that we may pitch at BBC Three or something, which I think would be very funny if it works. Might be a bit niche. I certainly thought it was funny. I can never tell.
And you, because when I first met you, which I think was 2000, you were already selling, I think then it was still tapes.
No, it's never been tapes, but it's never tapes.
It's CDs.
It's always been CDs, but the first one was a CD that I made entirely on my own band. First one was a CD that I made.
Why did you do that?
Because it became apparent that there would be a demand for it if I did. I mean, people started saying to me on a very regular basis at the end of the show, have you got any tapes, have you got any CDs? That was great. And so basically by about 97 it became apparent that were I to make something like this, and I could probably sell it. And it would also serve a dual purpose, as indeed has been the case, that okay, you sell it, you make your money on it, whatever, but it's now in people's houses and people start playing it to their mates and people start running, you know, in those days running cassettes off it, and the mates these days ripping off MP3 CDs of it to their mates, or, you know, stick lending the mates to stick onto their iPods or whatever. But, you know, it's out there and it's communicating with people in a, without you necessarily having to slough your ass up and down the country to do it. You know, it's spreading the word about you without you having to move. So, and I also like the fact that I liked the idea that, you know, pirate CDs and pirate tapes of my albums are being handed round to student dorms all over the country, because I think you have a lot of affection for artists that you discover that way. Certainly one of my biggest inspirations is Tom Lehrer, and that's absolutely how I discovered him. A mate of mine when I was 14 lent me a cassette with a couple of Goon shows on it, and I turned it over, and who was this guy? Who was this freak just singing these incredible, you know, scabrous bloody songs to the piano? And I, it was back in 1984, I assumed it was something contemporary, at the very least 70s. I was blown away when I discovered he was from the 50s. I thought, my God, this guy was there last time. And also what was particularly inspirational about him was how good the musical end of it was, and that's something which I always found a bit depressing about musical comedies, that the music side of it is often a bit perfunctory. The music side is and we'll just hammer three chords together and get a bunch of rude words to rhyme, you know. And one thing I was always very determined is that my stuff would work as music, so that, you know, the tunes would be real tunes, they would be real songs, even, you know, something which would still stand on its own as a song, even if the words weren't at all funny. Partly because I think that just it just enriches the whole thing, but also, again, I think it makes it funnier. I think the reason Baby I'm Sorry is funny is not just because it's got fart noises and burp noises and puke noises in it, but because it's genuinely quite an effective, quite a melodic love song with fart noises and burp noises and puke noises in it. You know what I mean? It's that sort of horrid contrast between what the song's actually saying and how it sounds that actually is it, that makes it funnier. Were it just a sort of, you know, because by and large, Crap Shag is kind of one-dimensional. It's a list and it has a funny tune. It sounds like a funny song, whereas Baby I'm Sorry doesn't. Baby I'm Sorry sounds like a ballad. Just happens to be a horrible ballad, you know. So, so you know, that's...
And what about foreign audiences? Do you get out to do...
Yeah, I mean, I haven't for a while. It's been a while. I did South Africa a couple of times. I've done Hong Kong and Shanghai. And I did Holland about 4 or 5 years ago. One something, an interesting thing I discovered with Holland. The songs worked, but not as well. Because I think, you know, the Dutch speak perfect English. They all speak absolutely perfect English, you know. Although they all speak it with an American accent because they all learned it from watching the TV. But one thing I discovered was the songs, while they liked them, they weren't necessarily getting them on every level that English speakers understood, because if it is your second language, however good at it you are, you don't necessarily get linguistic jokes. And a vital component of funny songs in general, certainly of my funny songs, is the clever rhyme, which again is something that's very much inspired by Tom Lehrer. He was a great stunt rhymer, you know, putting rhymes in the middle of, you know, landing a rhyme in the middle syllable of a word, you know, really crunching words to get them to rhyme with things. And I love that. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, if you speak English as a second language, however good your English is, you might not necessarily notice how funny that is. That's actually a funny rhyme in and of itself. You know, that was a good rhyme, you know, but you might actually think, yeah, that was actually a very funny rhyme. So, yeah, I mean, while it was fun, in actual fact, the spiel worked better than the songs, I thought, because there was a vital element of the songs that wasn't going over.
What about America?
I've not done America. I mean, the first place I did was Canada, but I've not done America. Done American audiences, I've done largely American audiences, and I've sometimes been told that my style is a bit North American. I've sometimes been told that I'm too slick. And I make no apologies for that. I don't regard... It's a weird thing. It's this weird post-punk thing we've got in this country that we kind of equate slickness with arrogance. We kind of equate knowing that you look like what you're doing with being a bit up yourself. Whereas I think the reverse is true. I think shambling on and just burbling any old crap and expecting them to love it just because it's you, I think that's arrogance. I think not knowing what you're doing is arrogance. You know, because you're essentially, you're being very presumptuous towards your audience. Whereas I think putting the hours in and knowing what you're doing and actually being a bit, you know, not polished, but certainly knowing what bit comes next and knowing, you know, I think that, if anything, is, I think that's humility. I think that's having, showing a bit of respect towards your audience and thinking, yep, you've come out of your house, you've paid your bloody money, you deserve somebody who's actually got his shit together, you know what I mean? I think, I don't equate that with arrogance at all, but somehow it's this weird post-punk thing.
Do you think there's also an element of, and there are lots of people who, Ross Noble being one, you being another, Bill Bailey being another, who are very, very good at what they do and have a tremendous experience and proficiency in what they do.
Yeah.
And therefore, in a way, it looks very easy, so therefore you get the sub guys coming on going, I'll do a bit of that, I'll do a Ross Noble intro, and they actually don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, well, certainly Eddie isn't responsible for more bad comics than anybody else.
Because it looks effortless, it looks people effortless. Don't realise how crafted it is.
Oh, absolutely crafted. He basically realised that if you could make it look like you didn't know what you were doing, while knowing exactly what you were doing, you could crack it, and that was what he cracked. Izzard has always looked like he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's always known exactly what he's doing. As in, he's always known exactly what he's going to say next on stage, and he's always known what he's going to do next with his life. You know what I mean? He's the most meticulously prepared comic ever. And but you did get, certainly less so now, but you could always tell by looking at the open spots who was big. When it was Lee Evans who was big, everybody was dying sideways across the stage and looking like they were panicking and everything. When it was Harry Hill, everybody was going, what's this? The chances are dead, ending, you know. And then when it was Izzard, everybody was trying to be, vague, and yes, and I don't know what I'm going to say. No, might not say anything. And after a while, you just think, I'll just finish a bloody sentence. Yeah, and yes, I accept this.
But I have
this
seen a lot of musical acts who have done the same.
We've
done
see who this
music,
is.
Yes, of course you can.
Hello? Okay, that's cool. Right, thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, I can't say. Well, I'm not aware of anybody copying me.
Maybe not copying, but there's certainly a lot of people who come on stage doing parodies and musical stuff. I've seen them, and it's quite horrendous.
Well, one of the things...
Well, they'll be good at one thing.
Yeah. Mm. One of the things, bizarrely, is I never can see the other musical acts.
Does
that
work
about
more than two on one night?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, the only time I ever see, like, Gribby is at Glastonbury. The only time I ever see Bill is at Glastonbury. I mean, that's the weird thing, because, you know, I used to look like Bill. I don't anymore because I've cut my hair off. But because I used to look like Bill, I've had 10 years of being told that I was trying to be Bill Bailey. And the funny thing is, I've seen him about 3 times ever.
Really?
So if I'm ripping him off, I should really do some bloody research. Well, the thing is, you know, I don't see the other musical acts. And I don't go to comedy gigs and me nights off, because I get very few nights off as it is. And if I do get a night off, the last bloody thing I want to do is go to a comedy club. Thanks awfully. Because I spent my life in comedy clubs. So the thing is, it occurred to me, if there were people coming up, through the open circuit, whatever, through the newbie circuit, who are basically knocking me off, I probably wouldn't know, because I won't get to see them. So they'll probably get away with it for far longer than if they were ripping anybody else off. Well, the thing is, I don't know if what I do looks effortless as such. I think I look like I know what I'm doing, and I think that's important, and I can sometimes sense if there's been a day, because, okay, sometimes, not very often, newer comics will come to me and say, who've got any advice, can you throw one? I say, because I can't give specific advice to anybody because everybody's different, right? You know, the only rule is be funny, and the trouble is nobody knows what funny is. You just know it when you see it. It's like porn. just know what it is when you see it, but you can't actually define it. Whereas the thing is, if I could say one bloody thing, and one word of advice to anybody starting to comedy, the word is authority. Own the bloody room. And it doesn't matter how you do it, there are many different ways of doing it. You've had to bulldoze everybody in the submission like I did. Look at Milton. Milton owns the room through sheer stillness.
Milton Jones.
Yeah. Milton just owns the room through stillness. You know, he just comes on and doesn't say anything for about 2 minutes and just focuses the room just with his sheer inertia, you know. And that's alarming, whereas, you know, big noisy bastard like me comes on and basically bulldozes everybody in, like I said, just, you know, shuts everybody up through sheer bloody force and volume. But if I could say that's one important, and sometimes I will be at a gig where somebody's been a bit gobby and he's been given too much space and the room's become too much about him and nobody's really imposing the authority on the room and the room's not focused as a result, you know, and the gig's been a bit dodgy and I have had gigs where the whole thing's been going tits up until I go on, and I will say that. I've had gigs where basically everything's gone all a bit pear-shaped until I've gone on. And it's not because I'm better than everybody else, because I'm not better than everybody else. But one thing I will do is I'll make damn sure everybody knows which... I will take command of the room. I'll make damn sure everybody knows which way they're meant to be facing, even if they then don't face that way. They know which way they're meant to be bloody looking when I'm on, you know. And because, you know, some comics don't quite establish that. You know. But I think also... It's weird. The one thing about being a musical comic, and I think I've got to the stage now where I'm not really subject to this anymore, because I think I've kind of established myself well enough for people to know what I do. It is a bit of a swings and roundabout thing being a musical comic, because you can get by as a mediocre musical act in a way that you can't as a mediocre stand-up. And in point of fact, you can rock as a mediocre musical act in a way that you can't as a mediocre stand-up. If you want to get encores and standing ovations and everything, when all you've been doing is saying there and standing there with a mic saying funny stuff, you've got to be a bit damn good. You've got to be pretty damn good to get that kind of response.
I've seen a lot of what I call beatbox comics who just come and they whip the mic, they can do the beatbox and they can hold an audience for 10 minutes.
10 minutes, 10 minutes, yeah. Well, you know, two of them are very good at it. Marcus is good at it, Stefano's very good at it, but a lot of them just like, nah, give it a fucking rest. But the thing is, as a mediocre guitar boy, you can rock in a way that you just can't as a mediocre guy with the mic. If you want to get standing ovations, like say, on course with the mic, you've got to be pretty damn good. But if you turn up a guitar, you get a bunch of rude words to write the tune of Mark Wild Thing, and you have to hit the audience and they're just pissed enough for a sing song, you're sorted. And I'll accept that. You can get away with that with a guitar.
Which goes back to what I was saying. So what makes you realise that push yourself beyond that?
Because I would go nuts if that was all I was doing. Mm. That doesn't interest me, and it would pull the arse off me, and I would hate my job if that's what I was doing. So I did it, and also it's not altruistic. I also realise that there is no bloody future in that. You can't getting rude words to write to the tune of Wild Thing. What are you going to do with it? Okay, you can, you know, have them falling over themselves at Jongleur's Bow on a Saturday, but you're ever going to get it on record? You're ever going to be able to do that on telly? You can't. It's dead end. You know, it's a more immediate result, but it's dead end. But the thing is, the kicker to that is, if you are like myself, and I say I think I've finally managed to transcend this now, but if like myself and like some of the other musical acts out there, you're trying to do something a bit cleverer, you're trying to do something a bit more interesting, maybe a bit deeper, maybe a few more bloody levels to it, you don't necessarily get credit from that from the comedy establishment. People just think, it's all right, it's dead easy for it. Well, no. It would be dead easy for me. I could make it easy for myself if I turned up and got a bunch of weird words to tune my Wild Thing. Whereas I'm writing a song where you don't even know what the joke is until you get to the first chorus and you don't recognise the tune because I wrote it. You know, and I've had audiences, you get audiences, maybe not the sharpest audiences in the world, who can literally lose interest by the time you get to the first chorus. So that's the thing, is it's you know, so some people are kind of dismissive of the whole genre of musical comic for the simple reason that you can get away with stuff in the musical comic that you can't get away with in the standard mic. But by the same token, you know, I can't bear hack impressionists. Can't bear who do the same three voices as everybody else, who do the Robert De Niro face, who do the Sean Connery voice, and just like, you know, and just, yeah, and do Martin, and just do the same four voices as everybody else, and like, and it never fails. Never bloody fails. The Robert De Niro face never fails, you know. Jeff's allowed to do it. Everybody else is a hack, all right? The Robert De Niro face, it never fails. We can all do the Robert De Niro face. We can all do it. Not everybody can do the voice. We can all do the face. But it's like, you know, we can all do that. And, but the thing is, it never bloody fails. But that doesn't mean I've got a downer on the whole genre of impressionism. If you see an impressionist absolutely nail somebody you've never seen an impression of before, that's a transcendent experience. It's wonderful. Like the first time you ever saw Alistair doing Richard Madeley. It's just gobsmacking. You just think, where did he pull that out of? You know, the first time I ever saw Ronnie doing Helen Baxendale, you know what I mean? The first time you ever saw John doing Tom Baker, you know what I mean? It's just, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. You see somebody doing a really good impression of somebody who doesn't just get done, you know, not Michael Caine, not Joe Pesci, not Phil Bank, you know what I mean? You know, that's absolutely transcendent. So I don't have a doubt on that. I think an impressionist is really working at his art, taking it into new things. That's brilliant, but God knows I've seen enough hack impressionists, you know. Hack magicians have seen enough. I've seen enough hack. And at the end of the day, also, I've seen more bloody hack white boys with a mic than I can get to think about. You have nights just thinking to yourself, if I hear the word IKEA again, I'm going to slip my throat. You know what I mean? And this is also this weird thing, that somehow the specials like the music acts or the black comics or the women. We all get herded into these little boxes where somehow we belong in. You know, oh well, no, the black comics go over there. Whereas somehow the white boys, the short-haired white boys in the suits, somehow apparently have access to this incredible breadth of material which has been mysteriously denied the rest of us. You know what I mean? Oh no, they're completely free-spirited, free-wheeling, free-forming guys who will surprise you at every turn. Or talk about them being dragged around like here by the girlfriend for 10 minutes.
Their mother discovering them wanking.
Yep, or cooking and wanking. So I stabbed him, and then I got off the bus. Yeah. So I stabbed him, then I got off the bus. You know what I mean? And it's, oh Christ. But I don't know, it is weird. But having said that, again, I don't have a downer with just, you know, regular observational standing there on the mic, because to see somebody doing that well, so I say Mickey Flanagan. The thing about Mickey is he's covering all the same ground as every third comic on the circuit. It's girlfriend stuff.
Different level.
It's, but he's just doing it better. You know, the use of language is just a bit cleverer. The choice of image is just a bit more telling, you know. And to my mind, that is harder. To do absolute meat potatoes feed punch observational humour that nobody wouldn't get, but which has actually got a bit of weight and depth and care and craft to it, I think that's harder than, ooh, I'm an ocelot, or just like swear, or fucking Tony Blair, or, you know, fuck, you know, it's much harder to come up with being bossed around by your girlfriend on a Saturday afternoon routine, but just takes the whole being bossed around by your girlfriend on a Saturday afternoon to a whole nother level. That's harder. That's like making really good pop music. Like making a really good 3-minute pop single that people will get the most out of the same, but will be happy to listen to in 10 years' time. I Can't Get You Out of My Head by Carly. Brilliant pop song, right? Got it the first time you heard it, but you're still happy to listen to it now. It's 5 years later, and you'd be perfectly happy to listen to it again in 15 years' time. That's the hardest bloody thing in the world in music, is to write the perfect 3-minute pop song. It's way harder to do that than to come up with some rambling 45-minute prog nonsense or some sort of, like, you know, 90-second noise terror. You know, it's way harder to write Can't Get You Out of My Head than it is to be Napalm Death or Genesis.